The headlines: Iran says terrorism is the common enemy of all regional countries, urging those countries to adopt a united policy in fighting for terror. Another Palestinian succumbs to injuries sustained from Israeli forces' gunfire, increasing the number of Palestinians killed during the past 5 days to 5 people. And Brazil's president says rioters who stormed the government buildings in the capital had inside help, adding that the presidential palace staff should be reviewed. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran has strongly condemned the terrorist bomb attack in the Afghan capital, Kabul, calling terrorism the common enemy of all regional countries. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a phone call with a Taliban-run Afghan government's foreign minister, Amir Khan Muttaqi. He condoled the staff of the Afghanistan Foreign Ministry and their families over the attack. The bomb attack, whose main target was Afghanistan's foreign ministry, left several people dead. Amir Abdullahian said the terrorists serve the goals of arrogance and intend to facilitate the domination of colonialist countries over the regional states. Iran's top diplomat also urged regional countries to adopt a united policy to fight terrorism. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister says the Islamic Republic of Iran will continue to support the Lebanese people, government, and the resistance with full force. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made these remarks upon his arrival in the Lebanese capital for an official visit. He urged all political groups in Lebanon to elect the country's president through dialogue and agreement. Amir Abdullahian added that political groups in Lebanon are able to choose the president without any foreign intervention. Iran's top diplomat is scheduled to meet with his Lebanese counterpart and the country's prime minister and parliament speaker during his visit. Earlier in our news review program, we delved into some experts from the remarks of the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, on the recent developments in Iran. Let's take a listen.
Time now for the news review of this bulletin. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the enemies made miscalculations when hatching plots to fuel the recent riots and to create disruption in the country. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said the enemies tapped into all of their available resources to plunge the country into chaos and turmoil. He said that they cashed in on people's livelihood issue as the country's economic situation was not very good. The leader added, among other techniques the enemies employed to stoke unrest were to sneak espionage teams into Iran, to promote Iranophobia worldwide through various propaganda ploys, and to incite ethnic, religious, political, and even personal sentiments. However, Ayatollah Khamenei noted that they failed to pull it off despite all of their schemes because of their miscalculations and Iran's firm resolve. Ayatollah Khamenei made the comments in a meeting with eulogists. Sayyid Mohsen Abbas is a journalist and political commentator joining us from London. Muhammad Ali Araka is also a journalist and political analyst, also joining us from London. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, I'll first start with you. I think it's noteworthy to put into an approach to this question as to the fact that Iran's leader says the enemy put everything they had in terms of any avenue that they felt that should be channeled in order to, go for their ultimate goal, which I'm guessing would be obviously for a change in the Islamic Republic system, but they failed. Isn't that one way of looking first at what Iran's leader has said?
I think it's fairly evident he failed. Of course, there was a huge occasion, and what they did, their cyber warfare techniques. They used every terrorism technique with all their proxy terrorists surrounding Iran and both internally within Iran as well. They've obviously upped the ante in terms of the economic maximum pressure scenario, which has been going on for, well, decades now. But of course, all of this has failed. The efforts this time, though, were particularly focused, I think, on also using some of the what I call the cultural psychological operations. I think they rather hope that the Iranian youth, the Iranian public, will rebel against the establishment because they prefer what we could only describe as Westoxified morality, Westoxified social and cultural agendas.
Taking a look at some of the channels that were used, Mohammad Ali Araki, do you believe that the way that this was devised was not to use just one, but to use all different avenues, as I mentioned in my first question, which would include the media, which would include the youth, the cultural aspect, throw in the espionage services of different countries, have an international campaign to vilify Iran, which overall is under the Iranophobia umbrella, all at once, with the hopes that this would obviously go for the aim of toppling, perhaps, the government. Which one of these do you think was either ranking high, and overall, why did it fail?
I believe that generally they planned it differently this time. So they had the economical side, the cultural side, and they also had the youth in, and they wanted to get the youth out against, especially the religious scholars. This was something that went on in Iran for a period of time. But I do agree with the fact that the Mahsa Amini events that occurred, it was something completely different. But as usual, they failed, and I expect the same to happen. If they attempt to do anything in the future, they will fail again.
Well, that's the whole thing. The idea of how to move forward on the same Mohsen Abbas is, of course, we can't continue this conversation without at least being mentioned how vigilant the security forces and besieged paramilitary forces have actually gone out and put their lives on the line to make sure that law and order is maintained, even though many of them have been killed. I believe there's over 80 at this point, or 82. I'm not sure about the exact amount, but kudos to them, and really hats off to them for putting their lives on the line. But at the same time, do you think that this pressure tactic that the West in general has gone after is going to continue? And what kind of role would Israel play in this whole thing? Because we know what they are after.
I think it is all about Israel. And the bottom line is that the Zionist lobby in Congress, the Zionist lobby, which has a hold on the Anglo-Zionist Imperial Alliance as a whole, dictates the terms and conditions of all the foreign policy, whether it's for Britain, America, or most of the EU now. So I'm afraid Iran has to stay braced for an ongoing, attack on their sovereignty. They have to stay embraced for the fact that the imperialism and the hegemony agenda, which the Americans have enjoyed across the Middle East, will continue. They have to also embrace the fact that their neighbors, who are puppets, the leaders at least, of their neighboring nations, like Saudi Arabia and others, Jordan, Egypt, all of those players in the West Asia arena who are essentially puppets of America and Israel, they will continue to also play a part, because it's from their territories, the territories even in northern Iraq, where the Kurds are again proxies and puppets of Israeli Americans, as well as the Azerbaijanis, as well as Afghanistan. All of these regions have terrorist organizations or operatives which are ready to try to infiltrate Iran, and I'm afraid that is going to continue. The foreseeable future looks at a complete collapse in any of those negotiations regarding the JCPOA and the efforts by the Americans and the Israelis to basically stop Iran from having any access to nuclear development and progress in that region. It will also jeopardize, of course, Iran's economics. And Iran has, of course, the more it's been put under pressure, the more Iran has learned to create what I describe as a resistance economy. So the ability to create its own manufacturing industries, the ability to reach out to the East and the Eurasian axis, the ability to be able to become part of the Shanghai Corporation, Cooperation or the BRICS alliance, the ability to also reject the dollar and to dump the SWIFT mechanism of engaging in finance around the world. All okay. these things are now inevitable. They're happening, and more and more of these things will obviously emerge. And the result will be that America's hold in that region will increasingly decrease.
Thank you. We're going to unfortunately have to end it there. Say Mohsen Abbas. Many thanks, journalist and political commentator. Mohamed Ali Araki, journalist and political analyst, both from London. Thank you to you both. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
Moving on, the Palestinian Health Ministry says another Palestinian youth has succumbed to injuries that he sustained during an Israeli raid near the West Bank city of Jenin. 18-year-old Abdul Hadi Fahri Nazal has been earlier killed and has been hit, actually, in the neck and the chest by Israeli forces live fire in the town of Kabatia. He was also taken to hospital in critical condition. Nazal was the second casualty of Israeli forces' assault on the city to arrest Palestinian fighters. Earlier, the 25-year-old Habib Mohammed Ismail died of wounds sustained from the Israeli forces' gunfire. The new fatalities came after Israeli troops killed 41-year-old Samir Aslan during an overnight raid in Arandia refugee camp in the occupied Al-Quds. Israeli soldiers have killed 9 Palestinians since the start of the year, including 3 minors.
One more Palestinian was shot dead early Thursday by Israeli soldiers, this time during a raid in Qalandia refugee camp north of Al-Quds. 41-year-old Samir Aslan was killed only minutes after his 17-year-old son Ramzi was arrested by the Israeli soldiers from their home. Aslan, with other family members, went to the roof of their home to watch what was going on, but a sniper shot him in the chest, and soldiers prevented his family members to transfer him to hospital until he died.
A large number of Israeli forces stormed Qalandia refugee camp and detained some 20 Palestinians. Then they headed to the home of the martyr to arrest his son Ramzi. The whole family went up to the roof to see what was happening when they heard loud screams, when an Israeli sniper opened fire and shot Samir directly in the chest.
After Samir was shot, his sons carried him down to transfer him to hospital, but the Israeli soldiers dragged him and put him on the ground and prevented anyone to rescue him. They left only after they made sure Samir succumbed to his injuries. This is a field execution.
Samir Aslan is the third Palestinian killed in the occupied West Bank in the last 24 hours. Israeli forces killed 18-year-old Sanat Samamri following an alleged stabbing attack in the southern occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil. On Wednesday, 21-year-old Ahmed Junaid was shot dead in the head during a military raid on the Balata refugee camp in Nablus, north of the occupied West Bank.
The continuation of these raids and campaigns means that this current Israeli cabinet will continue the aggressive policies against the Palestinians in a bid to fight resistance and prevent any form of activity in the occupied West Bank.
Tensions have been running high in the occupied Palestinian territories since last year. Nearly 180 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank alone in 2022. The United Nations said death toll was the highest since 2006 in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military's brutality shows no sign of abating and is cracking down on Palestinian fighters as well as the general population here. Palestinians warn of even more aggressive policies by Israel's current right-wing regime led by Benjamin Netanyahu. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Moving on, the Brazilian president says rioters who took part in the Sunday attacks on the government buildings in the capital likely had inside help. Lula da Silva pointed the finger at, quote, conniving agents from the police and armed forces.
I am convinced that the door of the Plan Alto Palace was open so that these people could enter because there was no broken door at the entrance. That is, it means that someone facilitated their entry here. We're going to investigate and see what happened.
The president said he had ordered thorough review of the presidential palace staff. The mop-up operation comes after backers of the former far-right president Jair Bolsonaro stormed the presidential palace, Congress, and the Supreme Court. The storming of government buildings was aimed at overthrowing Lula's government a week after he took office. They looted government offices, destroyed priceless works of art, and left graffiti messages calling for a military coup. Nearly 2,000 rioters have been arrested and more than 1,100 put under continued detention. A poll published on Wednesday said 93% of Brazilians condemned the Sunday's violent riots. The U.S. president is facing fresh scrutiny as a second batch of documents marked as classified have been discovered in a new location.
We're cooperating fully and completely with the Justice Department's review. As part of that process, my lawyers reviewed other places where documents from my time as vice president were stored, and they finished the review last night. They discovered a small number of documents of classified markings in storage areas and file cabinets in my home and my personal library.
Biden's attorneys found the documents in a storage at the garage of his Delaware home. The admission comes only 2 days after other classified records were found at his former office in the Penn Biden Center, a think tank based at the University of Pennsylvania. Biden claimed that he didn't know about those files and was taken up by surprise. The U.S. Justice Department has announced the appointment of a special counsel to investigate Biden's handling of sensitive government documents. The discoveries have presented legal and political headaches as the president prepares for a 2024 re-election campaign in the upcoming months. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The World Bank has predicted that the world's economy will face a sharp decline in 2023 due to soaring inflation and soaring interest rates. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Reuters news agency has covered this story and tells us more. The World Bank slashed its 2023 growth forecast on Tuesday, 10th of December, to levels teetering on the brink of recession for many countries as the impact of central bank interest rate hikes intensifies. Russia's special operation in Ukraine continues, and the world's major economies' engines sputter. The development lender said it now expected global gross domestic product growth of 1.7% in 2023, the slowest pace outside the 2009 and 2020 recessions in nearly three decades. In its previous Global Economic Prospects report in June of 2022, the World Bank had forecast 2023 global growth at 3%. The bank said major slowdowns in advanced economies, including sharp cuts to its forecast to 0.5% for both the United States and the Eurozone, could foreshadow a new global recession less than 3 years after the last one. The World Bank said in a statement accompanying the report, given fragile economic conditions, any new adverse development, such as higher-than-expected inflation, abrupt rises in interest rates to contain it, a resurgence of the COVID-19 pandemic, or escalating geopolitical tensions could push the global economy into recession. The World Bank said the bleak outlook will be especially hard on emerging markets and developing economies as they struggle with heavy debt burdens, weak currencies and income growth, and slowing business investment that is now forecast at a 3.5% annual growth rate over the next 2 years, less than half the pace of the past two decades. World Bank President David Malpass said in a statement, weakness in growth and business investment will compound the already devastating reversals in education, health, poverty and infrastructure, and the increasing demands from climate change. The World Bank report said China's economic growth in 2022 slumped to 2.7%, its second slowest pace since the mid-1970s, after 2020, as zero-COVID restrictions, property market turmoil and drought hit consumption in China. Production and investments were also lower. It predicted a rebound to 4.3% for 2023, but that is 0.9 percentage point below the June forecast due to the severity of the COVID disruptions and weakening external demand. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. In its half-yearly health check, the Washington-based World Bank said it had cut its 2023 growth forecast from 2.9% to 1.7% after the risk it identified 6 months ago all materialized. The World Bank's Global Economic Prospects report said the tougher-than-anticipated anti-inflationary measures, persistently high energy prices and continued lockdowns in China had led to a much weaker outlook for this year than it had expected last summer. Almost every advanced nation and nearly 70% of emerging and developing nations have had their economic growth forecasts cut. The World Bank's mission is to reduce poverty, and its president, David Malpass, said the deterioration in the global economic outlook meant the crisis facing development was intensifying. David Malpass said, emerging and developing countries are facing a multi-year period of slow growth, driven by heavy debt burdens and weak investment, as global capital is absorbed by advanced economies faced with extremely high government debt levels and rising interest rates. The World Bank President David Malpass added, the deterioration is broad-based. In virtually all regions of the world, per capita income growth will be slower than it was during the decade before COVID-19. The setback to global prosperity will likely persist. The World Bank said growth in the more prosperous advanced economies is projected to slow from 2.5% in 2022 to just 0.5 percentage point in 2023, adding that in the past two decades, slowdowns on a similar scale had resulted in global recession. excluding China, growth in emerging market and developing economies is expected to decelerate from 3.8% in 2022 to 2.7% in 2023. The World Bank said in sub-Saharan Africa, which accounts for about 60% of the world's extremely poor, growth in per capita income over 2023-2024 is expected to average just 1.2%, a rate that could cause poverty rates to rise, not fall. In fragile and conflict-affected countries, per capita incomes are expected to decline by 2024. World Bank President David Malpass said investment growth in emerging market and developing economies was predicted to be 3.5% a year between 2022 and 2024, half the average rate increase seen in the previous two decades. He added much-needed capital was being diverted to richer countries. The English website of Al Jazeera Television Network has also covered the same story. The head of the International Monetary Fund, IMF, warned this year will be tougher than 2022 for most of the global economy as the United States, the European Union and China see slowing economic growth. The International Monetary Fund's managing director, Kristalina Georgieva, said 2023 will be a tough year, with one-third of the world's economies expected to be in recession. Georgieva said during the appearance of the CBS program Face the Nation, she said, because the three big economies, the United States, the European Union and China, are all slowing down simultaneously. The remarks come after the International Monetary Fund back in October cut its growth forecast to 2.7%, down from 2.9% forecast in July, amid headwinds including the war in Ukraine and sharply rising interest rates. IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva said China, the world's second largest economy, is likely to grow at or below global growth for the first time in the past 40 years, as COVID-19 cases surge following the dismantling of its zero-COVID policy. Georgieva said she expected China's economic growth to improve towards the end of the year, but there are concerns about its longer-term trajectory. Meanwhile, economists said the lingering energy crisis is expected to cause further recession in the eurozone this year. Economists said prices in the region will rise by an average of over 6%, and unemployment rate will increase from the current 6.5% to 7.1%, by the end of 2023. High inflation and energy shortages will lead to a further decline in production and worsen the situation in the labour market. Subsequently, by the end of the year, the eurozone economy will shrink by 0.01%. Chiara Zangarelli, an economist at Morgan Stanley, said, "Gas markets in Europe remain a key risk. Additional supply disruptions or a particularly cold winter could lead to renewed tensions and prices rising again, forcing another round of adaptation and demand destruction."
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم إنا أعطيناك الكوثر فصلي لربك وانحر إن شانئك هو الأبتر. السلام عليكم dear ladies from all around the world. Welcome to a new episode of Muslim Lady. Well, today's episode is all a celebration on the auspicious occasion of the blissful birthday of the world's most outstanding lady. فاطمة الزهراء سلام الله عليها.
فاطمة مولاتي فاطمة، فاطمة مولاتي فاطمة، فاطمة مولاتي فاطمة، فاطمة مولاتي فاطمة، فاطمة مولاتي فاطمة.
On this very happy occasion of the birthday of Lady Fatima Salam Allah Alayha, I welcome you to a new episode of Muslim Lady. Salam Alaikum, Sister Zainab.
Wa Alaikum Assalam.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I also extend my congratulations to you on this very auspicious occasion of birthday of Lady Zahra Salam Alayha, which is also the
Women's Day.
Yes.
Women's and it's Eid, of course. Day.
Yes, of course. It's, for all women.
To all women out there, to all the Muslim ladies especially. And if we want to be the followers of this great lady, of this great outstanding lady, then we have to follow her lifestyle. As we have been doing that for weeks, we are focusing on the way she lived, on the narrations that actually has been passed to us. Through different books and different scholars. Now we know more about her. So if we want to achieve salvation according to her, if we want to be among her followers, we have to be more careful about how we act. And we have to know her more and more in order to get closer to how she was. So since we want to know more about her, Sister Zainab is here to tell us about the sources that are going to make it more clear for us to get closer to know her.
As you rightly mentioned that we got to know her more and more. The more we know her and the more we get closer to her, the more we can follow her. So there are many sources you can get to know about Lady Zahra Salam Alayha, but I would refer to a very few in this episode. The first source is obviously the Holy Book of Quran. We already mentioned that she is introduced in Surah Kawthar. And then there are many other surahs where she is mentioned. Like there's this verse of Tathir, or also called as verse of purification. It's the verse 33 of Surah Ahzab, which reads, "Indeed, Allah desires to repel all impurity from only you, Ahlul Bayt, and purify you with thorough purification." It talks about the purification of Ahlul Bayt, and the Shia school of thought also uses this verse as a source to defend the infallibility. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala introduces Ahlul Bayt in this verse and talks about their purification. Now, is there any verse that talks about how Fatima Zahra salam alayha is Ahlul Bayt? Yes, there is also the verse of Mubahila, which is from the verse 61 of chapter 3. And there was this encounter of Prophet, peace be upon him, with the Christians of Najran. And then they called the elders, and Prophet also called his Ahlul Bayt, making it clear who were Ahlul Bayt.
Yeah, thank you, sister. So, dear listeners, thank you for being with us. Let's go for a short break, and we'll be back in no time.
In the name of Allah, the All-Beneficent, the All-Merciful, indeed we have given you abundance.
Welcome back. You're listening to Muslim Lady. Well, dear Muslim ladies, we're talking about Lady Fatima Salamullah Alayha. And Sister Zainab was telling us about the purification verse in the Holy Book of Quran. And let's listen to more.
The verse of purification, which is also called as Ayat Tathir, or which is the verse 33 of Surah Ahzab, introduces Ahlul Bayt as pure. And then there's this verse number 61 of chapter 3, which introduces who are Ahlul Bayt, like Allah, Prophet introduces, or Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala introduces Imam Ali as Anfusana, the soul of Prophet, and he introduces Hassan, the Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein al-Islam, as Abna, the sons of Prophet, and Lady Zahra salamu alayha as Nisa'an, the women. There were many more people in the household of Prophet, Uncle Abbas, their sons, and so many other people, but he brought these chosen people and he called them as Ahlul Bayt. And you know, there was a verse coming in, the verse of verse 61 of chapter 3, introducing them, who they are. So it's very clear who are Ahlul Bayt. Then there's a verse about their infallibility. And also, there's one more verse which talks about her character, the way she behaved. Like there's a saying that she once was, her sons were very ill, and then she keeps fast. And then at the time of when she prepares iftar, some of the breads, then some of the three times the door gets, you know, struck, and there are people asking for food, and she gives away all three times, and then she breaks her fast with a glass of water. And then also a verse of Surah Hal-Ata or Surah Insan gets revealed, which says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, they are those who fulfill their vows and fear a day of sweeping horror and give food despite their desire for it to the poor, to the orphan, and to the captive. Talking about Quran, it talks all about her qualities. Talking about Prophet Muhammad is another source. His words are another source we can refer to her, who used to, you know, kiss her hand, stand for her in her honor, respect her. And, you know, in the days of ignorance, when everywhere was so ignorant, he would stand up in her honor and he would kiss her hands. And he would often, quite often, tell her that may your dad get sacrificed for you.
Yeah, teaching other men of his time, how is it to respect a woman?
Exactly. And on this, we would have no Women's Day if Prophet never did that.
Exactly. So yeah. How kind he has been to his daughter.
Exactly. So if we are receiving gifts today, if we're getting honor today, it's all because of his respect he showed towards his daughter.
Yeah.
And then also, obviously, Imam Ali al-Islam, how he used to refer to her. She also called him as Ya Sayyidina. He also referred to her as Ya Sayyidina, which means my leader.
Mm-hmm.
So do you see, even today, men have that kind of, you know, ego. They can't call their wives as leader.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Imam Ali al-Islam calls her as Ya Sayyidina. You know, you are my leader.
So this is the beauty of our religion, actually, that even our Prophet is such a respectful man toward women. Even his daughter, his wives, and all the women around him.
Yes.
So all these things have been passed down to us through the narrations. There's also another narration that says, Fatima is a part of me and the light of my eyes and the fruit of my heart, my soul. And this makes it pretty much clear.
You made it all, like, you did it all. Like, how from Prophet's words we can know about her.
Yeah.
What were his thoughts about her? Because in many places he also says that those who make her happy make Allah happy. Those who make her angry make Allah angry.
Yeah.
So this again shows the status of this pious lady.
And once more, I have to congratulate all of you, all the Muslim ladies out there in this happy occasion. Let's go for a short break and we'll be back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, dear ladies. You're listening to your program in today's episode, which is a happy episode because we're talking about this auspicious occasion, which is the birth anniversary of Lady Fatima Salamullah Alayha. And Sister Zainab is actually helping us with that.
Yes, sister. So we were talking about the sources we can refer to know more about the lady. So we talked about Quran. We said some of the verses like Surah Kawthar is there, I am Mubahila is there, the verse of Mubahila, the verse of Tathir, or the verse of purification, or also the verse of Surah Insan, which we can refer to know more about the lady. Then we said words of the Prophet, and you put it all in one of the hadiths that he calls her, that you are a part of me, you are a fruit of my soul, you are the one who makes you happy, makes Allah happy, the one who angers you, makes Allah angry. There are other imams as well, like Imam Ali alayhi salam. He says, he writes in letter to Muawiyah that there are certain things that are a matter of pride for me to, that Fatima is among us. And also Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says the same thing, that it's a matter of pride for us that Fatima salam alayhi is from us. Imam Baqir alayhi salam calls her Siddiqatun Kubra because, in the Quran, Lady Maryam, who has a very, very high status, is called as Siddiqa. But Imam Baqir alayhi salam calls Lady Fatima Zahra Siddiqatun Kubra. In the same way, like all imams have said something about her, and also the Imam of our time, Imam Zamaj Allah Ta'ala Farajah, says that she is my role model, which clarifies
everything.
Yes, like she can't be a role model for only Muslim ladies,
yeah,
but also the Muslim men out there. She's role model for oral, because she practiced patience in her life and so many other things. And patience or these other attributes are not something that only women have to practice in their life. Even males can learn a hell lot of things from her life.
Yeah. So, sister, even Allah himself is giving so much of importance to this one lady. Among all these men, he is making this woman so much of importance. And this is so much of messages to give everyone.
Apart from like Quran, apart from Prophet, the words of Prophet, peace be upon him, apart from Imams, these are the three major sources. Apart from them, there are writers. There are Muslim writers, there are Shia writers, there are non-Shia writers, there are Sunni writers. They have so many books about Lady Zahra salam alayha. And even there are non-Muslim writers.
Yeah, exactly.
One of them is like Sulaiman Qattani, who has written a book about Fatima al-Zahra, peace be upon her, Tendon in Shilf. And there are so many, so many other, it's not just one non-Muslim scholar. There are so many scholars who have researched upon her life and written big books about her. So her life is not only a symbol and a role model for Muslims, but also for non-Muslims. And her life in itself is a lesson. She has a daughter, was daughter with all her existence. She wept for her father. She acted as a nurse for her father when he would come from the wars. She condoled her father. She was daughter in all senses. She took care of her father in a sense that she got a title, Umme Abiha,
yeah,
the mother of the father. She was a wife, a loving wife, a caring wife, expressed love. She never compared her husband. She respected him a lot. She was a mother in all senses. She would play with her kids. She would sing for them. She would recite poems for them, and she would upbring them, and she would definitely take care of their spirituality. And talking about her importance, talking about her attributes, Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, which is also his birthday today with her, and see the coincidence. With the blessing of her birthday, with the blessing of coming on the same day, he became the leader of the revolution of Islamic
exactly.
Republic of Iran. He also says that, I am amazed about her virtues. The most one that strikes me or makes me ponder is the one that Jibreel, after Prophet Muhammad, when the revolution was cut, everything was over, in those 75 days when she is alive, he comes continuously to her and gives her condolences, gives her messages from Prophet, peace be upon him. So yeah, there are a lot of things we could know more about the lady.
Of course. She's the mother of all the women. She's the queen of all the ladies of heaven. So there's a lot to her to talk about. If a Muslim lady wants to know more about her, everything is available for her, and she could go for search and search and know more about her and apply it in her life. And that's all. So once more, sister, and all the listeners, I congratulate all of you in this happy occasion. May it be all blessings for you. Until another session, I bid you farewell. May Allah protect you and shower you with His blessings. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Biden has maintained many of Trump's sanctions against Cuba. Cuba says Biden applies blockade even more aggressively than his predecessors. On November 3rd, for the 30th time, the United Nations General Assembly called for an end to the illegal U.S. blockade against Cuba. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout wrote in this regard, the current U.S. government, the one of Joseph Biden, of all those that the Cuban Revolution has known, is the one that has most aggressively and effectively applied the economic blockade. Carlos Fernandez do Ocasio, Vice Minister of Foreign Affairs of Cuba, declared in a speech on December 14th, adding, "It is the one that punishes the most, the one that causes the most damage to the daily life of Cubans and the economy as a whole." Fernandez do Ocasio cited the disruption of Cuba's fuel receipt by sea and the extraordinary flow of Cuban migrants as examples of the severe harms that Cubans have faced under the Biden administration's implementation of the blockade. In his address at a conversation series on Cuba in the Foreign Policy of the United States of America held on December 14th at the Higher Institute of the International Relations in Havana, Fernandez do Ocasio took aim at the Biden administration's enforcement of the blockade against Cuba, stating, "There can be no doubt that the economic blockade is the defining factor in the bilateral relations between the United States and Cuba." Biden pledged during his 2020 presidential campaign that he would try to reverse the failed Trump policies that inflicted harm on Cubans and their families. In 2021, he claimed We stand with the Cuban people. But Biden's actions belie his words. Fernandez do Castillo said that Biden has applied with absolute and surprising loyalty the policy of maximum economic pressure that was designed by his predecessor, Donald Trump. Trump imposed 243 onerous new sanctions known as unilateral coercive measures in international law on Cuba as part of his maximum pressure strategy. More than 60 years ago, following the triumph of the 1959 Cuban Revolution, the U.S. regime imposed an economic embargo on Cuba. The rationale for the embargo was detailed in a State Department memo that advocated the disenchantment and disaffection of the Cuban people through economic dissatisfaction and hardship so they would overthrow the Fidel Castro government. The memo recommended the denial of money and supplies to Cuba, to decrease monetary and real wages, to bring about hunger, desperation, and overthrow of government. The embargo is not a single law, but a complex patchwork of laws, presidential proclamations, and regulations that Fidel Castro once called a tangled ball of yarn. American University professor and Cuba scholar William M. Leo Grand wrote in the National Security Archive, "It has evolved over the 60 years since President John F. Kennedy put it in place, loosening and tightening from one administration to the next, depending on the president's preference for using hard power or soft power in dealing with Cuba. Since the Cuban Revolution, the United States has waged an unceasing assault, both military and economic, against the Cuban people, organizing an invasion, assassinations, terrorist attacks against civilians, and systematic economic sabotage," Isaac Saini wrote at Resumen. "The blockade has cost Cuba more than $130 billion in damage, according to the United Nations." Fernandez do Castillo also mentioned the Biden administration's commitment in May to allow remittances to Cuba, but said that it still has not happened and there is no commitment to dismantle the measures announced by the Trump administration to disrupt the remittances. In addition, although the U.S. regime announced measures to boost internet penetration and interconnection in Cuba, the U.S. regime still prohibits access for Cubans to more than 200 private commercial websites, according to Fernandez do Castillo. This includes sites for education, health, science, and technology, art, culture, and innovation. The U.S. regime, Fernandez do Castillo stated, admits that it intends to promote the Cuban private sector, not to contribute to the development of the Cuban economy, not to improve the standard of the living of the population, not to help a majority sector of the population, but rather identifies it as an instrument of political subversion, a political weapon. Dozens of lawyers have signed an open letter to Biden stating there is no legal or moral justification for Cuba to remain on the state sponsors of terrorism list. They wrote, "Biden has the power to remove Cuba from the list and reverse many Trump-era sanctions through executive action. However, Biden has chosen to defend Trump's aggressive policies." Trump also stiffened the economic and travel blockade and activated Title III of Helms-Burton Act, which was enacted to discourage foreign investments in Cuba. Trump's activation of Title III greenlighted the thousands of lawsuits that will discourage tourism and investment in Cuba. In one such lawsuit, U.S. District Judge Beth Bloom issued an order on December 30 against four Florida-based cruise shipping companies that sailed to Cuba, requiring them to pay more than $400 million in damages. Fernandez do Castillo pointed out that Biden could have suspended Title III like Trump's predecessors. Activating Title III has had a deterrent impact on our development. Purpose of attracting foreign capital, he added. In addition, the Biden administration could have ceased the practice of pressuring governments in Africa, Asia, and Latin America to refuse medical cooperation provided by Cuba, Fernandez do Castillo said, adding, "This U.S. action, of course, is intended to prevent dozens of thousands of people from receiving medical services, which is what Cuban doctors provide." Biden could also have ended punitive measures, threats, and persecution against fuel exporting companies, shipping companies, port agencies, insurance and reinsurance agencies, all aimed at depriving Cuba of fuel supplies that our country requires to function, which has had an extremely severe impact on the economy and the lives of the Cuban people, according to Fernandez do Castillo. The blockade, the vice minister said, has an impact on everything that includes electrical service, transportation, the availability of medicine and material for medical services, and the ability to obtain supplies for food production and building materials. The U.S. government cannot pretend to treat Cuba as if it were part of its territory, or treat Cuba as if it were a colonial dominion, or treat Cuba as if it were an adversary defeated in a war. We are none of the three, Fernandez do Castillo declared. He cited Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel's observation that the intention of the U.S. regime is to strangle the Cuban economy and thus try to provoke social collapse and a political crisis in Cuba. Although the U.S. regime has failed in that purpose, it has led to economic depression in Cuba and the extraordinary flow of Cuban migrants. The embargo's overt purpose is to strangle the Cuban economy to promote regime change, according to the Alliance for Cuba Engagement and Respect, ACERE, a coalition of organizations working to end the Cuba blockade. The United States regime spends more than $25 million each year to fund regime change programs against Cuba. On November 3rd, for the 30th time, the United Nations General Assembly called for an end to the illegal U.S. blockade against Cuba. The vote was 185 in favor, 2 opposed, the U.S. and the fabricated regime of Israel, and 2 abstentions, Brazil and Ukraine. The resolution affirmed the sovereign equality of states, non-intervention and non-interference in their internal affairs, and freedom of international trade and navigation, which are also enshrined in many international legal instruments.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.